Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
All right, Matt. Did you hear about that Italian chef that had the terminal illness?
No.
Yeah, he passed away. You can only do so much. Now he's just a pizza history.
Okay. You gotta stop.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the graveyard. Thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Adam.
And my name's Matt.
Now, pull up a tombstone or settle into your casket and get comfortable, because this is Graveyard Tales. All right, everybody, here we are again. Matt, how you doing tonight, brother?
I'm doing good. I had to think about it, but I'm doing good.
Well, one can only do so much. So.
That's right.
Before we get into it, we want to say go over to patreon.com/graveyardtales. Sign up to become a patron. We have three different levels that you can sign up for. Whichever level you pick, we will love you, and we think you're going to get a good deal for that level. No matter the level you pick, you're going to get a bonus episode a week. It's like a short Graveyard Tales episode. If you move up to the $5, then you're going to get that plus the ad-free audio and video versions of the episode. Then if you move up to $10, you get all of that. Plus you get our second show, Side Quest, which has absolutely nothing to do with Graveyard Tales. It's just whatever me and Matt want to talk about that week.
Yeah.
We have played dumb games. We've eaten nasty jelly beans and sodas. Matt does trivia. I've done trivia on Matt. I like to tell Matt some stories that make it hard for him to sleep at night.
Yeah.
So go over there and check it out. We promise there's going to be something on our Patreon that you're going to like, and you can click that. I keep saying click, but scan that QR code above my head.
Yeah.
And, you can, it'll take you right to us.
Yep. And we've got a fun one I'm doing tonight. So, you know, I'm telling you, check it out. We really think you'll like it.
Yeah. Also, while you're online checking stuff out, Matt has this calendar that, no, I'm just kidding. Don't check that out. Go over and check out our advertisers for the week. If a company has sponsored an episode, we've put their link in our show notes. You can click right over and go to them and use our code, get you something for a discount over there. Also, check out our merch. We don't talk about it in the intro much. Matt always talks about it in the close, but in case you click off of it before we get to that, I'm going to say go check our merch store out. You can find the link down in our show notes as well, but it's Dashery. So graveyardtales.dashery.com. You can check it out. You can find us on TeePublic as well. Both have the same thing. Go over and get you some merch. We run flash sales occasionally, so it'll get you at a discount. Just watch our social media, and we will announce when we have a flash sale. But, Matt, that's all I got, because I feel like it's going to be a longer episode. So why don't you tell us, what are we talking about tonight, brother?
Okay, so tonight we're going to go to Victorian London, and I know what you're thinking. We're not going to talk about Jack the Ripper,
okay?
We're going to talk about another incident that absolutely terrified the residents of London, and that is Spring-Heeled Jack.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I think a lot of people have heard about Spring-Heeled Jack, but I doubt you really know the full story, and some of the details in this are just, they're incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you hear it and you think, wow, that's kind of a cool legend. But you have to understand this stuff really happened. This mm-hmm. stuff ran in newspapers.
Right.
And right. people, they changed their entire lifestyle because they were afraid to go outside after dark. People didn't let their daughters walk on the street alone
mm-hmm.
because they were absolutely terrified of Spring Hill Jack. So tonight we're going to dig into the legend. We're going to dig into the theories of it. We're going to talk about the history of Victorian London so that you really get a feel for how these people lived and what this experience was really like for them.
Right. And as we always say, go check our sources down in the bottom of the show notes. You can find where we found all the information. And if we talk about it, it's sourced and referenced down in our show notes. Now, before we talk about the creature itself, before we get into the attacks, the sightings, and the countless theories that have tried to explain one of England's strangest mysteries, we need to understand the world that Spring Hill Jack stepped into. Because legends don't appear out of nowhere. A monster belongs to a place. Every ghost belongs to a time. And Spring Hill Jack belonged to Victorian England. Specifically, he belonged to London in the late 1830s, a city that was transforming so rapidly that many people living there felt like they were watching the future arrive, whether they were ready for it or not. Imagine you're standing on a hill overlooking London in 1837. The city stretches to the horizon in every direction. Thousands upon thousands of chimneys belch smoke into the air. The Thames snakes through the middle of it all. There's crowded ships that are carrying goods from every corner of the British Empire. You hear church bells ringing in the distance. There's horse-drawn carriages that rattle over cobblestone streets. Factory whistles scream through the morning fog. This wasn't just the largest city in England, it was the largest city on Earth at that time. Nearly 2 million people were packed into London by the time Spring Hill Jack first appeared. Every year, more people arrived. Farmers left the countryside looking for work, laborers poured into the city, and entire neighborhoods just seemed to spring up overnight. And for many Londoners, it felt like the world that they had known was disappearing. The Victorian era had only just begun. Queen Victoria had taken the throne in 1837, the very same year that the first reports of Spring Hill Jack began circulating. Historians often think of the Victorian era as a time of confidence and progress, but the people living through those early years didn't know what the future would hold. What they did know was that everything seemed to be changing. New technologies were appearing every year. Factories were multiplying. Railroads were beginning to connect the country like it never had before. Scientific discoveries challenged old beliefs. Entire social classes were being reshaped. And the old world and the modern world seemed to be colliding. And whenever societies experience rapid change, fear follows close behind. People worried about crime. They worried about strangers moving in. They worried about losing control of the communities they had always known. Those fears would prove to be fertile ground for the birth of a legend. One of the places most closely associated with the early Spring Hill Jack reports was Clapham, in south of the city center. Today, Clapham is firmly part of London. And Matt, I had to look that up because
Clapham.
Yeah, it's spelled like Clapham. And to my American sensibilities, I would say Clapham. But I know that's not the way that it's pronounced in the UK. So I looked it up and everywhere I found said you pronounce it Clapham.
Mm-hmm.
So That's what I would have said.
Well,
you're weird. I would have said Clapham or Clapham Because the pH makes a...
But, yeah, you're right. Americans tend to pronounce that H a lot, like Cunningham, you know, and names like that. Birmingham.
Yep.
You know, and
Birmingham.
Instead of Birmingham. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, we do it. Hey, you guys say herbs, so
right.
We can say right. Birmingham.
We add the H in at a certain spot. Y'all add it at another spot. So yeah, and I've had friends from England that we have had constant arguments of aluminum versus aluminium.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, you're adding letters. You're adding letters to aluminum. And they're like, well, no, you're just not saying it right. I'm like, okay, whatever. So agree to disagree. But I'm going to try to say this correct. So Clapham. So today, Clapham is firmly part of London. It's busy, it's developed, and it's packed with people. But in the 1830s, it occupied an unusual space. It wasn't quite the countryside anymore, but it also wasn't entirely the city either. Large homes belonging to wealthy merchants sat alongside open land and stretches of undeveloped ground. Footpaths wound through fields. Roads were often poorly lit. After dark, a person could find themselves surprisingly isolated, despite being only a few miles from the heart of the world's largest city. The famous Clapham Common dominated the area. During the daytime, it was a pleasant open space, but after sunset, it became something else entirely. Gas lamps illuminated parts of the roads, but between those pools of light were long stretches of darkness. The farther you walked from the main roads, the quieter it became. And the darkness mattered, because darkness in Victorian London wasn't the darkness that we know today. You know, most people had never seen electric lights. And that's hard for us nowadays to even imagine. Because even if you go out to the country, like we like to go out to East Texas, out in the country where there aren't street lights at night. But you got headlights on your car.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got a flashlight. You got a phone with a flashlight.
Yeah.
Your house has porch lights. This was not the thing in Victorian London. It was dark. And I mean dark. Because they didn't even have the glow of the city. Where now, if you're a certain distance out from a big city, it may be dark, but you still get kind of that atmospheric glow.
Yeah. Yeah. Where I grew up was only about 15 minutes from downtown Nashville. And at night, you could look that way and you could just kind of see in the sky that, you know, there was this glow. I mean, you know, you could see it. I mean, you know, we're talking about 40 years ago. I mean, right. I can't even imagine what it's like now.
Yep. And it's that way with, we're not too terribly far from downtown Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, closer than I want to be to a downtown, but we're far enough out, but you can see Dallas on the horizon at night. So
that wasn't the case.
No,
there,
you got to take all that out of your thought. The city was illuminated primarily by gas lamps, and gas lamps created a strange world after sunset. Their glow flickered and danced. Shadows stretched and twisted. Faces appeared distorted. Objects seemed larger or smaller than they really were. So a figure standing 50 feet away could look almost supernatural. A person moving quickly through the darkness could vanish almost instantly. Victorians often lived in a world where their eyes couldn't fully be trusted, you know, as to what they were seeing, because the light played tricks on you. Adding to that atmosphere was London's infamous fog. Coal smoke from countless homes and factories mixed with natural fog to create conditions that sometimes reduced visibility to only a few yards. The city became a maze of shadows, smoke, and uncertainty. Imagine hearing footsteps behind you, You turn around, you see a figure emerge from the mist. Imagine trying to describe what you saw afterward. Would you be certain about what you saw? Or would your imagination fill in details? Now, that question would become very important in our story later. Other areas connected to early reports shared similar characteristics. Barnes, west of London, was still largely rural. Narrow roads cut through isolated stretches of land. Villages sat separated by fields and woods. Travelers often moved between pockets of civilization through areas where very few people would hear a cry for help. Now, Blackheath, southeast of London, already carried a reputation for danger. For centuries, the area had been associated with highwaymen and criminals. Stories of robberies and attacks lingered in local folklore, and residents didn't need much convincing that something sinister might be lurking nearby. And perhaps most importantly, Londoners already had a long tradition of believing in strange visitors from the darkness. Only a few decades earlier, another famous panic had swept through parts of the city. The so-called Hammersmith Ghost terrified residents who became convinced that a spirit was haunting local streets. Reports multiplied, witnesses described encounters, and fear spread. Eventually, the ghost turned out to be something much more ordinary, but the lesson remained. People had already shown they could become caught up in a mystery. They had already shown how quickly stories could spread. And by the late 1830s, those stories had a powerful new ally. The newspaper.
Oh, yeah.
The media.
Mm-hmm.
Getting those stories out. The Victorian newspaper industry was exploding at that time. For the first time in history, rumors could spread through an enormous population at remarkable speed. A strange encounter reported in one neighborhood could be discussed across the city within days. A frightening story sold newspapers. A mysterious attacker sold even more. Every article added details, and every retelling made the legend larger. Every witness who read about the creature became more likely to interpret a strange encounter through the lens of the growing myth. So, in many ways, Spring Hill Jack may have been one of the world's first truly modern urban legends, like a story amplified by technology. It was a mystery that spread through mass media, a monster perfectly designed for an age of newspapers and public fascination. And then there was another factor, Victorian entertainment. This was an era of stage magicians, elaborate costumes, mechanical inventions, and public spectacles. Inventors were experimenting with springs, mechanical devices, chemicals, and theatrical effects. Witnesses would later claim that Spring Hill Jack could leap incredible distances, clear walls, launch himself over rooftops, breathe blue fire, which we'll all get into. But to modern ears, those descriptions sound impossible. But to Victorians living in a world where technology seemed to be advancing at breakneck speed, the line between science and magic was often blurry. A clever prankster armed with unusual equipment could appear almost supernatural. Mm-hmm. A skilled performer could create an illusion that people would discuss for years. And it's all stuff they hadn't seen before.
Right.
You know, it's all new to them. Now, whether Spring Hill Jack was a man or a monster or something else entirely, he emerged at precisely the right moment. A moment when old superstition still thrived and when technology seemed capable of miracles. A moment when newspapers could spread fear farther than ever before and when millions of people were struggling to understand the rapidly changing world around them. The stage was set, the gas lamps were burning, the fog rolled through the streets, and somewhere in the darkness, people began reporting something impossible, a figure with glowing eyes, a creature capable of incredible leaps, a being that seemed to appear from nowhere and vanish just as quickly. And once the first stories emerged, they never truly stopped, because now that we've explored the world Spring Hill Jack inhabited, it's time to meet the legend himself. Talk about the reports and the attacks and the witnesses and the terrifying encounters that convinced countless Victorians They were sharing the streets with something that wasn't entirely human. And that's where Matt's going to go next.
So Adam just painted a pretty vivid picture of Victorian London. I mean, you've got gas lamps flickering through the fog, horse-drawn carriages rattling across wet cobblestones, and coal smoke hanging in the air, and 2 million people trying to make sense of a city that, like Adam said, it seemed like it was changing every single day. But here's the question. What if you lived there? What if one morning you woke up and discovered that the entire city was talking about the exact same thing? Not Parliament discussing it, not Queen Victoria, and not one of the spectacular crimes that London was already famous for. Something way stranger. At the market, people would lower their voices before talking about it. Inside crowded taverns, complete strangers were sharing stories. Coachmen began to avoid those lonely, dark roads, and families would insist that their daughters never walk home alone. You know, servants would whisper about it while they were tending the fireplaces and, you know, in these wealthy homes. And everywhere you went, you know somebody who swears they had seen it. But there's only one problem. No one can agree on exactly what it is. Some said it was a man. Others swear that it couldn't possibly be human. Some say it's a gentleman wrapped in a dark cloak. And others would say that his eyes burned like red coals. They talked about how he would laugh. Others said, no, he hisses. And even a few, as Adam said, would insist that he could breathe fire. But every single story ended the same way. Just when someone thought they had cornered him, he leaps away and disappears into the darkness and would just leave another terrified witness wondering if something supernatural had just happened to them.
Right.
Now, you know, today we would probably call this an urban legend. But back then, London called it Tuesday. Okay? This stuff happened all the time. But here's what's really fascinating about this. The panic didn't begin because somebody wrote a ghost story. So it didn't begin in a Penny Dreadful. You know, those little, almost like comics, the scary little books. It didn't even begin with an old folk tale that people would tell around the fireplace. It began because respectable newspapers started reporting that respectable people were describing something that they couldn't explain. And once those stories appeared in print, the city couldn't stop reading. It was gospel. Right. Okay, this is real because it's in the newspaper. And, you know, the strangest part of this is even the newspapers didn't seem entirely sure what they were chasing. You know, one of the reasons the Spring Hill Jack story has survived for nearly two centuries is because this wasn't treated as a campfire tale, at least not at first. The highest levels of London's government became aware of it. So think about that. The Lord Mayor wasn't spending his time investigating ghost stories.
Right, yeah.
He had riots to worry about. Crime, poverty, disease. You know, this was the largest city on earth. And if something found its way to his desk, people were taking it seriously. And in January of 1838, newspapers published reports describing a letter sent to the Lord Mayor by a resident of Peckham. The writer claimed that several young women had recently been frightened by a mysterious individual dressed in what appeared to be some sort of disguise. The attacks had become so frequent, so widely discussed, that authorities were being urged to investigate before someone was seriously hurt. One newspaper observed that the mysterious visitor had become, quote, the subject of conversation in almost every circle. Yeah. almost every circle. Everyone was talking about it. And so when everyone is talking about something, the mayor has to pay attention to it.
Sure.
So police began investigating. They began collecting statements. They were talking to the community. Newspapers questioned whether enough was being done. And as far as the authorities knew, someone was roaming London streets strictly to frighten women. Nobody yet suspected that they were watching the birth of one of history's greatest urban legends. Now, here's something that often gets overlooked. By the time the newspapers exploded with stories in 1838, rumors had been circulating for weeks, maybe even longer. A servant claimed she had been chased across an isolated road. A watchman reported seeing an unusually agile figure vault over a wall. Again, this is Victorian London. Vaulting over a wall to us now seems like an impossibility. If somebody told me today that they saw someone vault over a wall, I'd be kind of like, what? What are you talking about?
Yep.
But the coachman would talk of someone darting across lonely roads under the cover of darkness. Remember, it's really dark. Okay. And that darkness mixed with the fog and the smoke, you know, it was really, really hard to see, especially if there was somebody dressed all in black and they ran in front of you. You couldn't tell if it was a human or an animal or what.
Or a humanimal.
A humanimal. Now, unfortunately, a lot of these earliest reports were never fully documented. These were the ones that were just being circulated. You know, these were, you know, have you heard this story? Have you heard about this? Did you hear about what that coachman saw the other night? Okay, so they weren't ever actually, nobody sat down, talked to these individuals and wrote them out, at least not very well.
No, because, I mean, when something's starting out like that, you don't, as a rule, you don't think, well, I need to get all the details on this I can because this is going to be a big thing.
Right.
You know, it's not until that thing becomes a big thing that you then go, I need to start taking some detailed notes on what's happening.
Yeah. Again, this was like Tuesday. I mean, this was a regular thing in London. Odd things happening, people seeing stuff, weirdos roaming about. So nobody took it seriously until they were made to take it seriously.
Right, right.
We really only know about them now because later newspapers began to mention it, but just in passing. Almost as though nobody realized that they were witnessing something that was vital to the history of London. That this was going to change just about everything. And nobody had a name for this figure. This was way before anybody ever said Spring-Heeled Jack. It was just something, you know, waiting out there past that last little flicker of gaslight. And I know what some of y'all are thinking. You know, this sounds exactly like social media. And you're not wrong. I mean, you replace Victorian newspapers with Facebook, and you change out swap gas lamps for Ring cameras, and you put in one blurry cell phone video, and you have recreated the internet in Victorian London. I mean, that's it.
Yeah,
I'll tell you what. If I get one more message from my mother about look what I saw on the neighbors app or whatever that app is that lets you post the crap that comes up on your Ring camera.
Yeah, right.
I'm like, Mom, you gotta, this was just down the street. I said, you gotta quit looking at this.
Yeah,
that, you're freaking yourself out. I was like, if they show up on your porch, call me. I was like, but you know,
here's the thing. You think that you are going to feel better about your predicament by knowing all this stuff. You know, now we know who our neighbors are, and we know what's happening in downtown, and we know all this. Tell me, Matt, do you feel more comfortable and better now than you did in the early 90s before you knew all this crap?
Oh, no. No.
Right. Right. So the invention of being able to know what's happening all the time, every second of the day, no matter where it happens in your city, does not help.
Yeah, no.
You've got to stop looking at this stuff.
Right. You're freaking yourself out. It's like you're constantly running. You're turning off the light and running up the stairs of your basement. I mean, you're doing that in life when you do this stuff. Yep. And I'll give you a good example of not knowing. And when I was a kid, and I asked this, I said, you remember when they remade the Karate Kid movie with Will Smith's kid?
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so when that movie came out, I looked at the kid's mom and I said, would you be okay if we took, I can't remember which one it was, this child that was of this age, if we took her and a friend to the movie, gave them the money, let them buy their own ticket and go watch Karate Kid, and we'll go back home or we'll go do something else and we will pick them up. And it's whatever age they were in about third grade.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer was, absolutely not. Have you lost your mind? And I said, I know, but that is exactly how I saw the Karate Kid in the theaters. That is exactly what happened. And I was in third grade. My buddy's mom dropped us off on the sidewalk, handed us the money. We bought our own ticket, went in, watched the movie, came out. Mom picked us back up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That was it. And I'm like, here we are now. We wouldn't even dream of doing that.
Right.
Why?
Right.
Because we know more. Mm-hmm. People aren't any weirder now than they were then. I mean, truthfully, we probably just have more of them.
Yeah. We just know
it. We know it. And that's the thing. When all this stuff about these attacks started showing up in the paper, people knew it. It became real, and it spread like wildfire through the largest city on the planet. So
that's it. You knew what happened in the town next to you where 10 years before you
had no idea. I mean, you didn't know what happened in the neighborhood next to you.
Right.
I mean,
right.
You know, you could walk three blocks down and you'd like be like in a different world.
Mm-hmm.
But now you did. And when the newspaper started pushing it, because these stories sell, everybody was talking about it. So take that into consideration when you listen to these stories, that this is the way everybody was. Okay.
Yeah.
They were talking about it. They were looking out for it. You know, some people were probably even thinking, ooh, I'd love to experience this. You know, I want to see this, you know, yeah,
there was people that did that.
Oh, 100%.
We have them now. We have them now, the true crime junkies that want to insert themselves into these crimes.
Yeah.
You had the same thing then.
That's
right. The same kind of people then.
Yep. But then, after all that, one encounter changed everything. Not because it was necessarily the first attack, but because it was the first one newspapers covered in enough detail that people could put a name to the victim. And her name was Mary Stevens. So it was October in Clapham, the very neighborhood that Adam was describing a few minutes ago. If Mary noticed anything unusual that evening, history never recorded it. She had spent the evening visiting her parents. As dusk settled over South London, she began the typical walk home. It was a route that she had almost certainly taken many, many times before. And the gas lamps lit portions of the road, but beyond those little islands of yellow light, the darkness would become almost complete. The farther she walked, the quieter everything became. And then, without warning, the darkness moved. And according to the accounts that followed, a figure burst from the shadows and seized her before she had time to react. He grabbed her, pulled her close, and began clawing at her clothing. Several reports claimed that he repeatedly kissed her face while tearing at her dress with fingers she later described as feeling like, quote, cold and clammy like those of a corpse.
Gross.
That comparison has survived for nearly 200 years because it is so unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
Not rough hands, not gloved hands. The hands of a corpse. Mary screamed. I mean, as you would. And doors flew open. Neighbors carrying lanterns ran towards the sound, but by the time they got to her, the attacker had vanished. There was no desperate chase, no cornered criminal, just gone. And if that had been the end of the story, Spring Hill Jack probably wouldn't exist today.
Right.
But London was only beginning to understand what was happening. Now, the following evening, another strange report appeared. A horse-drawn carriage was making its way along a dim London road when something suddenly stepped into its path. The horses panicked, and the carriage overturned. So the passengers were thrown into the road, and people rushed to help, and several witnesses noticed a lone figure standing nearby. So you've got a carriage that just flips over, horses going nuts, people rushing to make sure that these passengers were okay, and somebody looks, and there's one person standing off to the side, not doing anything, just watching.
Yeah,
not helping.
It's just like today. If you've got a mass event that's happening, and people are freaking out and running or whatever, and you see one guy slowly walking the opposite direction or just standing off in the corner, just witnessing what's going on, you need to talk to that guy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
There's something wrong with that guy.
Yeah. If something like that happens and somebody casually walks away, that person knows something.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'd say they did it.
Yeah.
You know.
So when they noticed this individual standing off to the side, just watching what was going on, people started going, does anybody see this guy standing over here? What's his deal?
Mm-hmm.
And then without warning, he bounded toward a nearby wall. Witnesses claimed he cleared it in a single leap. Climbed it, not scrambled up it. He leaped.
He was the
go ahead.
The original Superman.
Yeah. And the news
leaped tall walls in a single bound.
Well, listen to this. The newspapers described the wall as being nearly 9 feet tall.
Oh, wow.
9 feet.
Not even basketball players nowadays jump.
I'm telling you, man, you're just 1 foot away from just jumping and standing on the rim.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Victorian newspapers weren't exactly famous for underplaying a good story, okay? So a 6 foot wall has a funny way of becoming 8. And, you know, 8 becomes 9, and 9 eventually becomes a rooftop, and the stories grow. But every witness agreed on one thing. Whatever they saw, it moved like no ordinary man. And just before disappearing, several claimed that they heard something that chilled them even more than the leap. It was laughter. Not nervous laughter, not frightened laughter, a slow, mocking laugh. Then once again, the darkness swallowed him up.
Yep. And he said, and your little dog, too.
But, I mean, you know, that's a weird enough story as it is. You know, just by itself.
The laugh is ominous.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ominous.
But just think, if you're one of those people that you know, was trying to help these passengers and you noticed that guy watching you, you would feel creeped out anyway because you thought, what is this guy doing? And then to see him make this impossible jump. So, okay, let's say the wall was really 6 foot. Does that make it any more or any less incredible, really?
No.
I'm not jumping no 6 foot wall. I'm not jumping a 6 foot fence. I'm not doing any of that.
I'm not jumping straight over a 6 inch fence. So, I mean,
I bet you could do that.
I am a 41 year old man with a 1 inch vertical.
Look, a picket fence, I'm not clearing it. Okay.
No.
Not in a single jump. No. I'm probably going to get my pants caught on it and fall.
Now, when I was a teenager, I did leap chain link fences, but I still had to like vault over them, hands on them and, you know, spring over it.
Yeah.
I wasn't just going, wee,
right,
like Mario
right.
and jumping over it.
Yeah. So after this happened, the next following days, people noticed that London had changed. Neighbors started comparing stories, and shopkeepers started debating these latest newspaper reports. Coachmen would refuse certain roads after sunset. Parents were worried. Police were searching. Newspapers printed account after account. And somewhere along the way, this mysterious attacker finally received a name. A name inspired by the one detail that everyone agreed on. These impossible leaps. So from that point forward, the strange figure haunting London streets would no longer be called the attacker. He became Springheeled Jack.
Leaping Larry. Oh, no.
Leaping Lanny Poffo.
It'd be a totally different story to this day if it was Leaping Larry.
That's right.
Good with Springheeled Jack. Leaping Larry or Jumping Jimmy, not
Jumping
the same.
Jumping Jimmy.
not the same ring to it.
No. But once the newspapers actually gave this creature, individual, whatever, an actual name, the legend just took on a life of its own. London believed that it finally knew what it was hunting, but it didn't. Because just a few months later, an ordinary knock at the front door of an ordinary family home would produce the most famous encounter of them all. This is the story that transformed Springheeled Jack from a frightening criminal into something that many Victorians believed might not be human at all. Now, by the time Jane Alsop heard the knock at her door, Springheeled Jack was no longer just a rumor. Okay, he had a name, he had a pattern, and worst of all, thanks to the newspapers, he now had an audience.
Right.
London knew the stories now. People knew about Mary Stevens. People knew about the carriage. They knew about the figure who leaped over walls and vanished into the darkness, and that's how a city becomes afraid. Okay. Something's out there and now we've got a name and everybody is afraid. But fear doesn't necessarily stay outside. It follows people home. It comes into their house. It gets under the door and it settles into ordinary rooms. And on the evening of February 19th, 1838, it came to the Alsop family. The Alsops lived in the Bow area of East London. And at the time, Bow wasn't quite the packed urban neighborhood that it would later become. It sat near the edge of London's expansion, where the city still gave away to quieter roads and scattered homes and stretches of darkness that the gas lights didn't really reach. But inside the Alsop home, it was probably an evening just like hundreds before it. You know, family nearby, a candle or lamp burning, and just those familiar sounds of ordinary life. And that's what makes the next few minutes so unsettling. Jane Alsop was not walking alone down a dark road. She was not crossing Clapham Common. She wasn't traveling between villages. She was at home.
That's a good point. Yeah.
And home is supposed to be the place where the monster stays outside.
Uh-huh. Okay?
Then came the knock. Not a pounding, not a frantic knock, not violent. Just enough to announce that someone was at the door. Jane answered. Outside, beyond the gate, stood a man wrapped in a dark cloak. Now, this was February, so the air was cold and damp. And it's the kind of London cold that doesn't just sit on your skin. It kind of works its way into your bones. Okay, so the man outside didn't attack. He didn't threaten her. In fact, what he said sounded urgent, even believable. And according to the reports that followed, he called out, "For God's sake, bring me a light, for we have caught Springhill Jack here in the lane." Now, just pause for a second, because that line is brilliant, and not in a good way. It's brilliant in the way that a trap could be brilliant, because if you're Jane Alsop, you don't hear danger. You hear that London's nightmare has finally been caught. For weeks, everyone has been talking about this mysterious figure, and the newspapers are full of him. Neighbors are whispering, police are searching, and now a man is standing outside your home saying, "We have him."
Yeah.
Okay? "Bring me a light. We've caught Springhill Jack." So Jane did what a lot of people probably would have done. She turned around, found a candle, lit it, and walked outside. So the candle kind of opens up the darkness as she walks closer and closer, and every step she takes, it shows a little bit more of this strange man. Every time she got closer, she got further away from the safety of her front door.
Yep.
And closer to whatever was waiting at the gate. And this is one of those moments that I wish that history had recorded exactly what Jane was thinking. Okay. Was she excited? Was she just curious? Was she scared? Did something about the stranger's voice make her hesitate and wonder, should I go out there? Or did she truly believe that she was about to see London's most wanted man captured out in the lane? Well,
I bet she believed.
Yeah, I would think so. But we'll never know for sure. But what we do know is what Jane said happened next. She approached the man with the candle. The stranger stood still, and then, as Jane brought the light close enough to see him clearly, he threw back his cloak. Jane froze, because the man standing in front of her no longer looked like a man, at least not like any man she had ever seen. Reports published afterwards described him wearing a close-fitting white garment, sometimes said to resemble oil skin, beneath that dark cloak. His head was covered by something witnesses later described as a helmet or a cap. But it was his face that froze Jane in place. His eyes appeared to burn. Some reports said they resembled balls of fire. Others described them as glowing red coals. Whatever the exact wording, the image is the same. You know, two burning eyes staring at Jane in the candlelight. And then she saw his hands. Or maybe more accurately, his fingers. Remember those fingers that felt like a corpse?
Mm-hmm.
Jane claimed they ended in sharp metallic claws, long, bright, glittering in that little bit of candlelight. Now, this is one of the reasons that Jane Alsop's account is so important. She did not claim she was looking at a ghost. She didn't say a spirit appeared in the yard. She described details like a cloak, a tight white garment, a strange head covering, glowing eyes, metal claws. Whether she understood what she was seeing, that's another question. But she was describing something physical, something that was standing right in front of her, something close enough to touch.
And the metal claws would explain the cold, clammy feeling.
Uh-huh. And can you imagine, he's in this black cloak, okay? And we've talked so much about how dark Victorian London would have been. And remember, the Bow area was kind of on the edge of London. It would later become more of an urban, you know, well-populated area. But at the time in 1838, it was not. It was, you know, much more like just beyond the suburbs. So it was dark. And she is out there with nothing but candlelight. And this guy turns and he is wearing this basically a white leather suit. Okay. Just think about what that would have looked like, how stark that would have changed what Jane saw when he turned around and pulled that black cloak that hid him in the darkness so well to wearing this white suit and that candlelight. I mean, it must have looked like a magic show. I mean, he just went from being almost in shadow to ta-da.
Yeah.
So when I read that, I think even though it was dark and all Jane had was a candle, that contrast had to be so much that she got a really good look at what this was in front of her.
I'm sure.
So, yeah. I mean, you know, there's so many descriptions of things people see. And you always have to take into account, well, they were afraid or it was dark or, you know, it was moving too fast. It felt like it lasted for minutes, but it was probably only just a couple seconds. And so they saw something and their brain just kind of made it into something else. Okay. And that's absolutely possible here. But when you think about, you know, she's holding the only light out there. And the contrast of the colors and what she described, I just feel like she got a really good look at what this figure had to describe those kind of details. The metal claws that would have kind of, you know, shone in the candlelight. And especially against that stark white of, you know, against the black cloak.
I was about to say the white would then reflect more of the light so that then it would illuminate more of his features and the weirdness of him.
Yep. So there's Jane. This thing has turned around, standing close enough to touch her. And then something happened that almost never appears in the stripped down versions of this story. Jane said the figure smiled. I don't know why, but that detail is so unsettling to me that this individual went through all this flourish to show her what he was and then smiled, because smiling is a human thing, you know, it means intention, awareness, even planning. So whatever stood in front of Jane Alsop that night, it knew exactly what it was doing.
Yeah.
But then came the moment that transformed Spring Hill Jack from a frightening criminal into something that sounded almost impossible. The figure leaned toward her close enough that Jane could see his face, close enough that the candlelight caught his eyes, and close enough that she could see those strange metallic claws. And he then opened his mouth, and according to Jane, blue and white flame burst from his lips. Now, Victorian newspapers loved that detail.
I bet.
One account described him as emitting flashes of fire. Another used the much more dramatic phrase that he, quote, vomited forth blue and white flame. That's impressive. And, you know, we hear that and we immediately start thinking about explanations. Chemicals, it's a stage trick, alcohol. It's some kind of early special effect, right?
Yeah.
But think about this. Jane Alsup had never seen a special effect in her life.
That's
to
true.
Her, standing just a few feet from a cloaked figure with burning eyes and metal claws, it must have looked like the devil himself had just jumped out of the dark. So for one horrifying instant, the blue fire lit up everything. His face, the cloak, the claws, the eyes, everything Jane had been unable to see from the doorway was suddenly right in front of her. And then he reached for her. For just a fraction of a second, Jane stood frozen, which you would too.
Oh, yeah.
The candle was still burning in her hand, and the blue flames vanished almost as quickly as they appeared. And before she could move, Springheel Jack lunged, and he grabbed her. According to the newspaper accounts that followed, he grabbed at her clothing with those strange metallic claws, tearing through the fabric as Jane struggled to pull away. The candle fell from her hand. It struck the ground. You know, the flame went out, and so now the only light came from the faint glow spilling through the windows of the Alsup home. So Jane fought with this thing. She screamed. She twisted and pulled with everything she had, and reports published in the days that followed described her clothing as having been torn in a remarkable manner. Her neck and arms were scratched. Her shoulders had marks from the attack. And those details are important because, unlike so many ghost stories, this wasn't just a frightened witness claiming she had seen something strange. There were actual injuries. There were torn clothes. There was physical evidence that someone or something had assaulted Jane Alsup that night.
And probably had claws.
Yeah.
Metal claws.
Absolutely. So whatever stood in that yard left its mark. And then several witnesses would later describe hearing something that made the entire encounter even more disturbing. Laughter.
Again. Yep.
Not a shout, not a growl. Laughter. That same mocking laugh that had been reported after the overturned carriage incident. That same unnerving confidence. Almost as if terrifying someone was the entire point.
Yeah.
Now, inside the house, Jane's screams broke through the family's evening, and family members rushed out the front door. Now, Jane's sisters were the first to arrive, and close behind her came her dad. But as they reached the yard, they found Jane desperately struggling with this mysterious figure. But the sudden arrival of a lot of people changed everything. So whatever Springheel Jack had intended to do, his opportunity was over. So he released Jane, turned and fled. Not down the road, not through the gate. According to the reports, he disappeared with astonishing speed into the darkness before anyone could catch him. And so once again, just as people thought they had him, he was gone. Lost in the darkness where Springheel Jack seemed to begin. So the next morning, London woke up to another headline. But this time, the story was different. This wasn't another frightened servant or another rumor that got whispered in a tavern. This was Jane Alsup. This was a named victim, a respected family with a daughter that had visible injuries, and a statement so bizarre that even newspaper editors struggled to believe what they were printing. One newspaper described a figure wearing a tight white garment beneath a dark cloak. Several of them mentioned glowing eyes. Nearly all repeated Jane's extraordinary claim that the attacker had breathed blue and white fire. Now, some people believed every single word. Others read it and said, this is nonsense.
Ain't no way.
But almost everyone talked about it.
Sure.
Spring Hill Jack had become the most discussed figure in London. Parents warned their children, and young women refused to travel alone. Volunteer patrols began searching the streets after sunset, looking for him. This caused the police to intensify their investigations. And surely, someone had to know who this man was. And then it seemed that they finally had their answer. Now, not long after Jane's attack, police arrested a young man named Thomas Milbank. Now, for the first time, London believed that the mystery might actually be over. Milbank had reportedly been near the area, and he fit the general description well enough that suspicion fell on him almost immediately. Newspapers eagerly reported the arrest. Readers breathed a sigh of relief, and maybe Spring Hill Jack wasn't some impossible creature after all. Maybe he was simply a violent criminal who had finally made one mistake too many. But then, the police's case began to fall apart. Now, when Jane Ossoff was asked whether Thomas Milbank was the man that attacked her, she didn't hesitate. She said, no, that's not him. And she remained adamant. The man who attacked her had burning eyes and metal claws. And most importantly, he had breathed blue and white fire. Thomas Milbank could do none of those things. Now, does that prove that Spring Hill Jack was supernatural? No, it doesn't. But it does tell us something important. Jane refused to change her story simply because police had produced a suspect. Because that would have been easy.
Right.
The pressure to identify someone must have been enormous. Instead, she stood by her account. Without enough evidence to connect Milbank to the attack, he was released. And just like that, the mystery went even deeper. Because now London knew something it hadn't known before. The police could arrest ordinary men, but Spring Hill Jack was still out there. And before the city had time to catch its breath, another young woman would come forward with a story that sounded impossibly familiar, and her name was Lucy Scales. So just 8 days after Jane Ossoff's terrifying encounter, Spring Hill Jack struck again, or at least someone fitting his now famous description did. And this time the victim wasn't in Bow. She was in Limehouse. And her name was Lucy Scales. And unlike Jane, Lucy wasn't alone. She was walking with her sister after visiting their brother when they passed through an area known as Green Dragon Alley. That sounds like something out of a Harry Potter book.
Green Dragon Alley.
It also sounds like a place that you don't want your daughters walking after dark. I don't care what year it is. Okay?
Yep.
Don't go to Green Dragon Alley after dark.
Yeah.
But the sisters noticed a figure standing in the shadows. And at first, he didn't really seem all that unusual, but then he stepped toward them. And according to Lucy's statement, the stranger suddenly leaned forward and expelled a stream of blue flame directly into her face.
Again?
Yeah, not orange, not yellow, but blue. Which is the same detail Jane Ossoff had reported only days earlier. Now, Lucy, she immediately collapsed. Okay, Lucy fainted, which, you know, I would expect. But her sister rushed over to help her and later said Lucy appeared so overwhelmed that she suffered what newspapers described as violent fits for several hours afterwards.
Oh, wow.
Now, the attacker, just as before, disappeared before anyone could catch him. But here's what makes Lucy Scales' account so interesting. She had never met Jane Ossoff. The two women lived in different parts of London, yet both described a mysterious figure, both mentioned unusual clothing, and both independently claimed that he produced blue fire. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they encountered the same man. But it's one of the reasons this story has fascinated historians for nearly two centuries. Some details repeat often enough that they just become impossible to ignore. So by this point, London had crossed the line. People weren't simply talking about a dangerous criminal anymore. They were beginning to wonder whether something much stranger was stalking their streets. Now, over the weeks that followed, reports continued to pour into newspapers. Some almost certainly described ordinary assaults. Others were probably pranks. Some may have been copycats inspired by the growing legend, and undoubtedly, a few were likely nothing more than frightened imaginations filling in the blanks. That's what happens with a public panic. One story takes hold, people begin interpreting ordinary events through an extraordinary lens. Yeah. But here's the problem. Even after you account for exaggeration, even after you allow for sensational journalism, and even after you assume a handful of hoaxes, you're still left with something that isn't easy to explain. That sounds very familiar. Sounds like something I've said for decades about Bigfoot. Okay?
Yep, for sure.
So you have multiple named witnesses, independent accounts, physical injuries, and police investigations. And newspapers that, despite occasionally indulging in dramatic language, were reporting events they genuinely believed had occurred. Okay? They did not think that they were printing hoaxes or ghost stories. Okay? They were actually printing news. Now, whether every detail was accurate, it doesn't really matter. The fear behind it was real. And this is where something just really amazing happened. The newspapers didn't just report Spring Hill Jack. They helped create him. I mean, the earliest reports described a mysterious attacker, a man in unusual clothing, someone frightening women before escaping. But as the weeks went on, the descriptions became more elaborate. The leaps became higher. The eyes glowed brighter. And the claws, they got longer. And the fire was even more spectacular. So it's almost like watching folklore develop in real time. Every witness added a brushstroke. Every newspaper added another layer. Until eventually, the man and the legend became almost impossible to separate. But despite all the patrols, despite the police investigations, arrests, frightened citizens keeping watch after dark, no one ever caught Springhill Jack. There was no confession. There was no undeniable suspect. No explanation that fully satisfied everyone. So instead, the mystery grew. And with each passing month, the question became bigger. Was there really just one attacker? Or several? Was Springhill Jack an unusually athletic criminal? Or an elaborate prankster? Maybe it was a series of copycats feeding off newspaper headlines. Or had London witnessed something that it just simply couldn't explain? Those questions would not go away. In fact, they followed Springhill Jack way beyond London. Because just when it seemed the panic might finally be fading, the reports began to appear somewhere else. And then somewhere else. And years turned into decades. The Victorian era, it went on. Children who had once been warned about Springhill Jack grew into adults. And gas lamps gave way to brighter streets. And London continued to change. But somehow, the legend refused to disappear. And that's when Springhill Jack stopped being just London's mystery and became England's mystery. I mean, for most mysteries, time has a way of providing answers. You know, witnesses eventually come forward and evidence somehow shows up or somebody just confesses. Eventually. The truth will catch up. But that's never happened with Springhill Jack. Something even stranger occurred. The man, or whatever people believed him to be, just simply refused to disappear. And as the years passed, the panic that had gripped London slowly began to fade, and new crimes filled the newspapers, new scandals would capture public's attention, and the city kept on growing. You know, there were more lights on the streets. Railways now stretched farther across England, and life just moved on. But every so often, another report would appear. Another frightened witness. Another impossible leap. Another reminder that Springhill Jack had not been forgotten. And some people believed that he had returned. Now, one of the most famous later reports came nearly 40 years after the London panic. But then, by then, many assumed that Springhill Jack had become nothing more than an old story. And if it was a regular guy, he was either dead or too old to pull this crap anymore. But then came Aldershot. And according to newspaper reports, a sentry was standing guard one evening outside the military barracks when he noticed a figure approaching through the darkness. He challenged this stranger. He got no response. He challenged him again. Still nothing. This figure continued to walk toward him. Military procedure gave the sentry every reason to be on alert, so he prepared himself. But what happened next wasn't what anyone expected. The figure suddenly sprang forward with astonishing speed. Rather than attacking with a weapon, he reportedly struck the soldier across the face with an open hand. He got to this guy fast enough to slap him. And some accounts say more than once. Like he was mocking him.
Yeah, I was going to say, slapping a grown man is...
A soldier!
It's a degrading thing.
An armed soldier.
Right.
So... Other soldiers rushed towards the disturbance, and several reports claim that shots were fired. Now, whether they actually struck the figure, no one could really say, because before anybody reached him, he bounded over a nearby wall.
Of course.
Disappeared into the night. 40 years later.
That is a spry geriatric.
I'm telling you. Somebody spiked this guy's geritol, okay? The pattern...
Those Ensure drinks are great.
he's getting those protein ones. That's what it was.
Hashtag not a sponsor. Maybe they should be.
I was going to say, we're not too far off. you go see me switch from Red Bull to Ensure. You're going to know.
Yeah, right.
Yep, Matt and Adam have been at this a little long. Yeah. But here was this pattern again, okay? An attack, jumping over a wall, same deal, all these many years later, and he escapes. No explanation. Mm-hmm. So by now, like we said, Springhill Jack no longer belonged solely to London. Reports began to surface from other parts of England, like Sheffield, the Midlands, Lincolnshire, even Scotland. Now, were all these reports describing the same individual? That really seems unlikely. I mean, like I said, 40 years had passed. If the original attacker had been a young man in 1838, he would have, like Adam said, been way old by the time. I mean, he was at least in his 60s, you would think.
Yeah.
Okay? So.
60s to 80s is...
Let's just guess that he's 20 when this starts. So he's at least 60. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
58 if you say he was 18. Everybody reports it was a man. Nobody says it was a kid. So, you know, we'll say at least 18. Now, what was going on? How is this even possible? The simplest explanation is that imitators had appeared. You know, once the newspapers made Spring Hill Jack famous, anyone wearing a strange costume and frightening people after dark suddenly became part of the legend. I mean, we've seen this in history. Okay, one sensational story inspires another and then another, and the legend grows larger than the actual original event. But perhaps the strangest chapter of all of this unfolded in Liverpool in September 1904.
Liverpool.
You can do it. I can't do it. You do it. I'll let you do it. But
most people would disagree.
You know, we're talking about 1838 to 1904. Think about how much the world had changed. Okay. Queen Victoria had died. The 19th century was over. The Wright brothers had already flown at Kitty Hawk. Photography had become commonplace, but somehow the newspapers were once again printing stories about Spring Hill Jack. Resinus described an extraordinary figure leaping across rooftops, not climbing, not scrambling, leaping. Some witnesses insisted he crossed entire streets in a single bound before landing effortlessly on the roofs of nearby buildings. If you go and search Spring Hill Jack and do an image search, you will see a really famous drawing of Spring Hill Jack, and it looks like he's jumping. He's doing this ridiculous little prancy jump, and he looks like he's on a rooftop. There's a chimney and everything. Okay. That mm-hmm. all of that is from this. Okay.
Hmm.
Others claim they watched him disappear into the darkness before anybody could get close. And the reports spread quickly, just like they did before. Crowds would gather, the police would investigate, and some newspapers even suggested that hundreds of people either claimed to have seen the mysterious figure themselves or knew someone who had. Was that number exaggerated? Probably. Victorian and Edwardian newspapers loved dramatic headlines. But the excitement about it was real. And for a brief moment, it felt as though Spring Hill Jack had returned. But then, just as suddenly as the stories began, they stopped. No arrest, no confession, no body, and no explanation. Only one more unexplained chapter. And you know what? That may be the most fascinating part of this whole story. Because most criminals are forgotten. Hoaxes fade away, and local legends never travel beyond the town where they begin. Spring Hill Jack did something almost no mystery ever accomplishes. He crossed the line from news into folklore. And before long, writers began using him in serialized fiction. The cheap Victorian penny dreadfuls transformed him into everything from a villain to an unlikely hero. His name appeared in stage productions, comic stories. Children frightened one another with tales of the mysterious man who could leap over walls and breathe fire. And the newspapers may have introduced Spring Hill Jack, but popular culture made him immortal. Okay, so here we are 2 centuries later. No more gas lamps. There's no more horse-drawn carriages. And the London that Mary Stevens and Jane Alsop knew exists now only in old photographs. The witnesses are gone. The police officers who investigated the cases are gone. The newspaper editors who first printed those incredible stories are gone. But somehow, the question remains. Who, or what, was Spring Hill Jack? Was he an unusually athletic criminal who terrified Victorian London before slipping into history? Was he several copycats whose stories merged into one legend? I mean, did he frighten witnesses unknowingly, build one of history's first true urban legends? Or is there still something about these reports that refuses to fit any neat and tidy explanation? I don't know. And, you know, at this point, we probably will never know. And I'm not so sure that I want to, because I think this story, the whole mystery is more fascinating than the answer ever would be.
Yeah.
Okay? Yeah. I mean, that's where legends belong. Okay? I mean, and Spring Hill Jack is 100% a legend. But like I said at the beginning, the attacks were real. The reports were real. Things happened. Witnesses saw it. People were attacked. There were injuries. There were torn clothing. So we know at least that part of it was real. Now, you know, what it became, you know, is the legend. But nobody was ever able to come up with a definitive answer as to Spring Hill Jack's true identity, you know, if he was human or not. And, you know, Adam and I have kind of kicked this story around, and, you know, we probably don't even agree on everything about it, but, you know, it's worth thinking about, you know, what could it have been? You know, we talked about this before, but, you know, it's like, man, this dude would have had to been old.
Yep.
How in the world did anybody jump that high? Even if it was embellished at 9 feet, you know, somebody saw somebody jump a 6 foot wall. Okay.
I have a kind of out there theory, and I also have a kind of out there thing I want you to think about that I've been putting together in my head for a few days. So first of all, let's take out how long this time frame would be. So let's just look at the incidents. Mm-hmm. You've got in 1837 ish, something like that, is when it first started. Okay, so it starts out with a grab and a kiss that we know about. Before that, it was like scaring horses and, you know, smacking a donkey on the butt, just weird stuff. And then it progressed. And then you had the lady attacked and scratched. Mm-hmm. Now, what do we now say most criminals do that are serial killers? They progress. Mm-hmm. They don't start out immediately killing. Okay. So you're watching a progression happen. And I'm not saying I believe this. Don't put it down as this is what Adam believes totally, but it's just something I'm mulling over.
It's interesting to consider.
We have that Spring Hill Jack in the 1830s. Then in 1888, we have Jack the Ripper start his killings. And then it disappears. Now, I'm kind of knocking out the later Spring Hill Jack deal because I think that's probably copycat. Mm-hmm. But if we look at the way both are portrayed to have dressed, they have the long black cloak slinking around in the shadows.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is it possible that Spring Hill Jack was the impetus for Jack the Ripper? His story went from Spring Hill Jack all the way through Jack the Ripper, and it culminated with all the murders of Jack the Ripper.
I mean, we kind of hinted at this together, you and I, before we ever hit record. And it is very interesting. that they didn't happen together. I mean, they were what, about 40, almost 50, 50 years apart, mm-hmm. 50 years apart, almost exactly 50 years apart.
Yeah.
1888 was the year that Jack the Ripper, was active. Yep. So 38 was when Spring Hill Jack was what? So a 50 year span. We don't have a bunch of Spring Hill Jack stories like we do leading up to the one, in Aldershot with the soldiers. That seems to where it really kind of ends the big stories. You know, there were others around that time, but that was the one that was the most well known and was really as close to Spring Hill Jack. And so roughly 10 years later, you have Jack the Ripper. The only thing, and you said it at the beginning, take out the time frame, you know, yeah. the amount of years that passed, if it would have been the same person, because you right. gotta, if we guess that the Aldershot incident, if he would have been, let's say, 60, okay, then Jack the Ripper would have been in his 70s. Doing mm-hmm. this, if it was the same person.
Right.
But I do like the idea that it could be a copycat, that he may have started with scaring women inspired by Spring Hill Jack, and it led to something else. Yeah. But I think at this point, they've kind of, they pretty much pinpointed who they believe Jack the Ripper was. Yeah,
I think through DNA and stuff,
they've, you know, the age would, you know, would kind of, you know, I think it, 5 years ago, this would have been a great theory.
Yeah, right. But
of course, DNA ruined it all. If it wasn't for you meddling DNA experts, you know.
Now, I do wonder, is Jack in England like John Doe here? Because it's Spring Hill Jack, Jack the Ripper. We don't know their names, and they'd call him Jack. And here we call him John Doe.
Probably.
You know, it.
Well, Jack, you know, is a nickname for John. So maybe, mm-hmm. maybe it was given the Jack nickname because, you know, it was just an easy tag. You know, instead of calling him like you said, Leaping Larry or, you know, Jumping Jimmy, you know, it sounded better. It just sounded better to give him a common name.
Right. You know, my crazy theory, though, that I want to throw at you is just to throw it at the wall and see how it sticks. Since there is such a large time frame and since the geography grows a lot, is it possible that this is one of the very few times we have a documented demonic activity? Because if it were demonic, then the time and the geography wouldn't matter. He could go from England to Scotland and back and traverse the 60 years or whatever. And I'm hesitant to say that, but when we did the Patreon episode and we talked about it, it would explain the jumping, the fire, the red eyes and everything. Now, stage theatrics could explain a lot of that. I'm not sure how they would have done the red eyes. That was the one we were stuck on when we talked about it initially. Yeah. The fire, I can see the claws, the whatever, but the red glowing eyes, would be the hard one for me to say would be stage.
Yeah. Theater. I mean, believe it or not, out of all those things, that would be the tough one, because there were theater performers that could breathe fire already.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it doesn't take long before you figure out this liquid burns and this liquid burns and this liquid burns. And
this one, and this burns one, orange. This
yeah,
one
that's
burns
what I
blue.
Said. This one's orange. This one's blue. This one's yellow. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you can work up a parlor trick or a production, a street performer that can breathe blue fire. You know, it wasn't impossible at the time. The thing that I think makes it more difficult is it's kind of hard to do anyway, even as a show,
yeah.
Much less while you're trying to attack somebody.
Right. And if you're talking and laughing beforehand and nobody sees you
put liquid
in your mouth.
In Jane Alsop's case, he's calling out to her. Now he's got his mm-hmm. back turned, so maybe he calls out and then puts liquid in his mouth. Okay. But he's got to have something to create a flame. I mean, he didn't have fire in his mouth.
You would see a spark.
You
right?
would, but you I know. Mean,
especially
they
being
weren't walking
dark.
Around with a Bic at that time.
True. True. It had to be a match.
But I mean, that would have been the easiest thing if he had put the liquid in his mouth, turns around, strikes a match. You know, Jane is distracted by the big flourish, throwing back the cloak, and then he's mm-hmm. got a mechanism where have you ever seen those old lighters where they pull the thing out, and when you pull it out, it looks like a metal match and it's on fire?
Yep. You can still get those for survival.
So something like that, he pulls out, breathes the fire on her. Now the liquid's out of his mouth. He's breathed the fire, and even in the report, it only lasted for a brief moment. Now he can speak mm-hmm. again. He can laugh. Okay. The metal claws, they could absolutely create those.
Easy.
But you're right. Yep. The burning red eyes, I'm not 100% sure how they would have pulled that off, because, I mean, nowadays, you'd like, well, yeah, he was wearing some kind of like weird
LED mask.
Yeah, an LED mask, weird contact lenses, something, you know, but they didn't have battery powered lights. You know, there was no LED, you know.
He didn't have miniature gas lamps in his eyes.
No. So it is kind of weird, you know, but
that's the hardest one for me to explain, because even the leaping over walls, it could be exaggerated.
Sure.
And he could have jumped to the top of one and scrambled up, and then the papers would have said he leapt the wall. So I think, I don't know what everybody out there thinks, but for me, the one thing that hangs me up on stage performer, besides the time frame, is the glowing eyes. What in the world? How?
But you know, there was one guy, and you've talked about him before, that history points the finger at, and that's the Marquis of Waterford. You know, Henry de la Poor Beresford, who was the third Marquis of Waterford. The reason history points at him is because he was this wealthy Irish aristocrat, and he was known for drinking and fighting and vandalism and pulling off these elaborate practical jokes. Okay. He was young. He was immature. He was somebody that would have thought terrifying women in the streets would have been absolutely hilarious. And a lot of people felt like he was wealthy. He had the money and the interest mm-hmm. to pull off some of these kind of tricks. You know, he could have done it himself. He could have hired people, you know, to build these costumes and to make these elaborate shows with the fire and the eyes and all this stuff, and even some type of mechanism that might have allowed him to jump really high. You know, I mean, we don't know, but there was never any evidence that tied the Marquis to the attacks. You know, this was one of those things where history looks back and says, ah, it had to be that guy. It just had to be. He was the only one. I'm like, just because his lifestyle and his, you know, fortune made him a likely suspect, it doesn't mean that he was a suspect, you know?
Right.
They, you know, according to the stories, there was no one ever pointed to him as saying, hey, we think it might be this guy.
Yeah. Why don't you look at this guy?
It is an amazing story. And, you know, I know if you have not heard the full story of Spring Hill Jack, you are missing out. And so we hope that tonight's show kind of lets you in on what became possibly one of the very first urban legends. And something that completely terrified Victorian London and is one of the earliest examples of social media starting a complete buzz. I mean, yeah, it's right. Just, it's just, it's got everything. So thank you guys so much for listening. Let us know. Have you got theories? You know, what do you guys think about Spring Hill Jack? Was he supernatural? Was he demonic? Was he some wealthy aristocrat? Or was he just, you know, some crazy pranking adventure? You know, he was just like, you know, building all this weird stuff to scare women. Let us know. And the best place to do that is in our Facebook group. It's called The Graveyard. We've got thousands of people in there sharing stories, you know, asking for help with weird paranormal problems, telling jokes, all that stuff, you know, posting pictures of weird lights in the sky. We've even seen some really cool stuff here as of late. So if you're not already, go in there and check it out. Don't forget to check out our website, which is graveyardpodcast.com. There you can find links to purchase Graveyard Tales merchandise. You can listen to the show and you can become a patron. And thank you so much to everyone who has supported the work that Adam and I have done over the years. We cannot thank you enough. So until next time, we'll save you a seat in the graveyard.
See you soon.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.